counts as a unilateral three-day pause in its retaliatory attacks on Saudi Arabia as a goodwill gesture towards a lasting peace. U.S. President Joe Biden says Russia's Vladimir Putin should no longer remain in power, a speech later downplayed by the White House. Also ahead, Qatar says no country can replace the Russian energy supplies after Ukraine urged energy-producing countries to boost their output to take the place of Russia's supplies. Welcome to the program. Yemen announces a unilateral ceasefire suspending all rocket and drone attacks against Saudi Arabia and affirms its readiness to turn the declaration into a permanent commitment.
We announce the cessation of offensive confrontations on all field fronts for a period of 3 days, and we affirm our readiness to turn this suspension into a final, continuous, and permanent commitment in the event that the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia announces the withdrawal of all foreign forces of the coalition from our Yemeni lands and waters and a complete stop of its support to local militias in our country.
Mashhad said Saudi Arabia must end its blockade on the Republic of Yemen once and for all. He said Yemen is also ready to perform a full prisoner exchange. He called on the UN Special Envoy for Yemen to take steps to prepare the agreements to carry out the exchanges. Meanwhile, the head of Yemen's negotiating team says Riyadh must prove its seriousness in response to the Yemeni peace plan by responding to the ceasefire, lifting the siege, and withdrawing troops. The developments follow the Yemeni army targeting multiple locations deep inside Saudi Arabia, including an Aramco oil facility in Jeddah and vital sites in the capital, Riyadh. Thousands of Yemenis have taken to the streets of the capital, Sana'a, and several other cities to mark the National Day of Resilience. Our correspondent there reports.
Following one of the largest retaliatory attacks by the Yemeni army against Aramco facilities across Saudi Arabia, thousands of Yemenis filled the streets of Yemen's capital Sana'a and other major cities to mark the National Day of Resilience.
The Yemeni people are free. 7 years of crime have passed against us, but this has been matched by 7 years of steadfastness, freedom, and defeat of the enemy. The Yemeni army has manufactured weapons, including ballistic missiles and drones, and this is by the grace of God. And as Mr. Abdul Malik al-Houthi said, now a new phase of confrontation with the Saudi enemy will begin. Our big gathering today is to confirm that we will remain steadfast until we win and expel the occupier.
The protesters expressed their support for the army's recent aerial operations, saying the Saudis only understand the language of force and it is a legitimate right as it is self-defense against Riyadh's war and siege.
All the Yemeni people are supporting the operations which has been against the Saudi facilities, economic and facilities, and also military facilities. We are revenging violations have been committed against the Yemeni people since March 2015, and we are very sure that we are now in the year of victory.
On Friday, the Yemeni army launched fresh attacks against several targets in Saudi Arabia. The attacks caused a heavy blow to Aramco's facilities in Jeddah, Jazan and Najran, as well as Ras Tanura and Rabigh refineries. The Yemeni army said it has also targeted vital sites in Riyadh with ballistic missiles.
People here say the 8th year of the war will be different as the Yemeni army has already proven that it is capable of hitting Saudi targets, including its oil facilities. The Yemenis believe that Riyadh will eventually have to consider a political solution, at least to protect its oil giant Aramco in the face of Yemeni attacks. Avlatif al-Washali, Sana'a.
Author and Middle East expert Kevin Barrett says the Saudi-led coalition's war on Yemen is a war for money on behalf of oppressors.
The Yemenis have been outspent by a factor of dozens, if not hundreds, to one. They have most of the most powerful countries in the world lined up against them, and yet they've somehow managed to not only fight the Saudis to a draw, but they're actually winning. The Saudis can't stop them from hitting these economically vital targets in Saudi Arabia itself. When this war began, very few people were predicting this. Early on in that war, of course, the Saudis thought it would be over in a couple of weeks. And as time drew on, we kept hearing, well, we'll get there. We just need more weapons from the West. And they would spend hundreds of millions or billions more on weapons and indiscriminately bomb the Yemeni targets from very high altitudes because the Saudi pilots don't want to get down low enough where they're exposed to any risk. And that's the problem. The Saudis don't have anybody fighting on their side that really believes in the cause. They know that they're fighting on behalf of an oppressor. They know that they're fighting for money, not for real spiritually important reasons, not for honest self-defense. And the Yemenis know that they're defending their country against an oppressor, and they're willing to die for it. And that makes all the difference. And in that situation, a David can defeat a Goliath.
The war on Yemen has entered its eighth year. The brutal Saudi-led campaign has been nothing short of death and destruction, marked by diseases and malnutrition. Countless people have died as a result of bombardments. And while the world mourns what is happening in Ukraine, Yemen is not given the attention it deserves. Meanwhile, the main driver of the war, the U.S., continues providing arms to Saudi Arabia and the coalition backed by Riyadh. Here's a report.
Saudi Arabia's brutal war on Yemen has entered its eighth year. In March 2015, Saudi Arabia, in collaboration with a number of its allies, launched a bloody war against Yemen. The United States and several Western countries, including France and the UK, provided the Saudi-led coalition with arms and logistics support. The armaments that the U.S. has been providing the invading coalition have included precision ammunition, which the Saudi-led aggressors have been using amply against residential areas and other civilian targets. Soon after Riyadh began the war, the Pentagon started assigning a commando unit to the border between Saudi Arabia and Yemen to help the kingdom in the face of Yemeni defense forces' increasingly sophisticated retaliatory attacks. American military personnel have also been attending command and control centers on the Saudi and Emirati territories so they can best advise the countries about how to proceed with the war.
The Saudi regime, along with the UAE, backed by the United States and its allies in the region, including most notoriously Israel, continue to push for a wide-scale military operation against Yemen and the Yemeni people.
The objective was to return to power the former Riyadh-backed regime and to crush the popular Ansarullah resistance movement, which has been running state affairs in the absence of an effective government in Yemen. In 2014, the people of Yemen led a popular uprising against the Saudi-backed unpopular regime of Abd Rabbu Mansur Hadi. As protests gripped the country, the Ansarullah resistance movement took control of the capital Sana'a, following a rapid advance south from their northern stronghold of Sada'a. The popular protests were against the incompetent and corrupt regime in Sana'a, backed by Riyadh. In a bid to crush the resistance and reinstall the Hadi regime, a Saudi-led coalition launched a ferocious bombing campaign on the neighboring Arab country barely 6 months later.
They are fighting against these imperialist forces that are coming to destroy Yemen. And so we see that continuously. The Saudis, along with Sudanese mercenaries, the UAE, and other mercenary forces, backed by U.S. and Israel and NATO countries, continue to provide weaponry to bombard and kill indiscriminately civilians, to destroy civilian infrastructure.
With the war on Yemen dragging on, one thing has become obvious. The Yemeni army has made great strides in resisting the bombardments and countering the Saudi-led coalition with missiles and drone attacks. This report tells you better.
The ferocious bombing campaign on Yemen and the subsequent war that was launched in the country has stopped well shy of all of its goals. but the war has killed tens of thousands of Yemenis and has turned the entire country into the scene of the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
The United States military-industrial complex, the national security state, along with its regional and international partners, continue to push for war, continue to push for the destruction of the Houthi forces, and want to see a Yemen that is under imperial domination and that is beholden to Washington, to Tel Aviv.
The Saudi-led coalition has been preventing fuel shipments from reaching Yemen while looting the impoverished nation's resources. UN officials estimate that more than 3 million Yemenis have fled their homes due to the war. Nearly 300,000 people have also sought asylum in other countries. Internally displaced Yemenis often must cope with a lack of food and inadequate shelter. Many Yemenis who have not fled are also suffering, especially those in need of health care. The UN Children's Agency, UNICEF, describes the conflict as a living hell for children, with 1.8 million under the age of 5 suffering from severe malnutrition. The UN has said it needs billions of dollars to help the 17.2 million people. According to the UN Office for Humanitarian Coordination Affairs, more than 23 million out of the 31.9 million people in Yemen face hunger, disease, and other life-threatening risks as the country's basic services and economy are collapsing. The war has also devastated Yemen's infrastructure. Dozens of schools, hospitals, health facilities, factories, and refineries have also been destroyed.
But we've seen also the Houthis gain the upper hand. In recent days, Yemeni forces have taken a wide swath of territory and just recently have targeted again Aramco oil facilities. So this war shows no sign of letting up, but it's clear that the Yemeni people will continue to fight and to struggle for their national liberation and for their right to self-determination.
However, Yemeni armed forces and allied popular committees have grown steadily in strength against the Saudi-led invaders and have left Riyadh and its allies bogged down in the country.
In other news, Iran's foreign minister says resuming talks to remove sanctions against his country remains on the government's agenda. Hossein Amir Abdullahian was speaking in a televised interview with IRIB. He said an agreement is close, but the key outstanding issues first need to be resolved. The Iranian minister said any possible outcome will not go beyond the framework of the 2015 deal, known as the JCPOA. Comments come as the European Union's coordinator for the talks, Enrique Mora, is set to visit Tehran on Sunday to settle the unresolved issues. Iran says it is ready for a good deal if Washington removes the sanctions in a verifiable manner. Tehran demands guarantees that there will be no more withdrawal by the U.S. from a deal as it did in 2018. The U.S. president raises eyebrows after a suggesting that his Russian counterpart should not remain in office. Take a listen.
We will have a different future, a brighter future, rooted in democracy and principles, hope and light, of decency and dignity, of freedom and possibilities. For God's sake, this man cannot remain in power. God
bless you all. In response, Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said the Russian president is elected by the people of Russia and that is not up to Biden to decide who should be in power in the country. The White House later explained that Biden was not calling for regime change in Russia. It said the U.S. president meant to say that Putin cannot be allowed to exercise power over its neighbors or the region. Russia's ongoing campaign in Ukraine has raised concerns over energy supplies across Europe. Qatar says no one can replace Russian gas exports immediately as the EU is seeking to diversify away from Russia towards other suppliers.
I don't think we can help and nobody can replace. I've said this very clearly. The volume that we're talking about, 30 to 40% of gas coming from Russia to Europe, is not something that can be replaced overnight. It needs time.
The Qatari official was addressing the Doha Forum. His comments came a day after the U.S. signed a deal to supply 15 billion cubic meters of liquefied natural gas to the EU this year. Saad Sherida Al-Kaabi said providing such a large volume would take nearly 7 years. Earlier on Saturday, Ukraine's president also addressed the Doha Forum. Volodymyr Zelensky called on energy-producing countries to ramp up output to help the EU wean itself off Russian supplies. The Ukrainian president said energy-producing countries like Qatar could contribute to Europe's stability. Russia is the EU's number one energy supplier. The bloc imports nearly 40% of its natural gas and over a quarter of its oil from the country. The European Union aims to ramp down its gas dependency by two-thirds this year. That comes as energy prices have already soared in Europe due to the Ukraine conflict and Western sanctions on Russia's energy sector. Moscow's demand for gas payments in rubles has added to concerns of an energy supply squeeze and led to even higher prices. Moving on, millions of people across the world celebrate Earth Hour. That's a symbolic lights out event that aims to call attention to environmental issues and the necessity of protecting the planet. The annual event encourages people to turn off their non-essential lighting for an hour and take a break from using electronic devices during that period. Earth Hour takes place every year on the last Saturday of March. The theme of this year's event is Shape Our Future, and has been celebrated in more than 180 countries, including Greece, France, Thailand, and Iran. The initiative was first introduced in 2007 by the World Wildlife Fund as a grassroots movement for highlighting the collective responsibility of the people towards their environment.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
It can't be emphasized enough just how many taxpayer dollars are now being showered on the Pentagon, says William Harting, journalist, in an article titled $778 billion and counting. Who is paying for all this Pentagon waste? Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Was another banner year for the military-industrial complex as U.S. Congress signed off on a near-record $778 billion in spending for the Pentagon and related work on nuclear warheads at the Department of Energy. That was $25 billion more than the Pentagon had even asked for. It can't be emphasized enough just how many taxpayer dollars are now being showered on the Pentagon. That department's astronomical budget adds up, for instance, to more than four times the cost of the most recent version of Biden's Build Back Better plan, which sparked such horrified opposition from Senator Joe Manchin and other alleged fiscal conservatives. Naturally, they didn't blink when it came to lavishing ever more taxpayer dollars on the military-industrial complex. Opposing Build Back Better while throwing so much more money at the Pentagon marks the ultimate in budgetary and national security hypocrisy. The Congressional Budget Office has determined that if current trends continue, the Pentagon could receive a monumental $7.3 trillion plus over the next decade, more than was spent during the peak decade of the Afghan and Iraq wars, when there were up to 190,000 American troops in those countries alone. Sadly, all too periodically, Biden's decision to withdraw U.S. troops and contractors from Afghanistan hasn't generated even the slightest peace dividend. Instead, any savings from that war are already being plowed into programs to counter China, official Washington's budget-justifying threat of choice. And all of this despite the fact that the United States already spends three times as much as China on its military. The Pentagon budget is not only gargantuan, but replete with waste, from vast overcharges for spare parts to weapons that don't work at unaffordable prices to forever wars with immense human and economic consequences. Simply put, the current level of Pentagon spending is both unnecessary and irrational. Overcharging the Pentagon for spare parts has a long and inglorious history, reaching its previous peak of public visibility during the presidency of Ronald Reagan in the 1980s. Then, blanket media coverage of $640 toilet seats and $7,600 coffee makers sparked public outrage and a series of hearings on Capitol Hill, strengthening the backbone of members of Congress. In those years, they did indeed curb at least the worst excesses of the Reagan military buildup. Such pricing horror stories didn't emerge from thin air. They came from the work of people like legendary Pentagon whistleblower Ernest Fitzgerald. He initially made his mark by exposing the Air Force's efforts to hide billions in cost overruns on Lockheed massive C-5A transport plane. At the time, he was described by former Air Force Secretary Warren Orr as the most hated man in the Air Force. Fitzgerald and other Pentagon insiders became sources for Dina Razor, a young journalist who began drawing the attention of the media and congressional representatives to spare parts overcharges and other military horrors. In the end, she formed an organization, the Project on Military Procurement, to investigate and expose waste, fraud, and abuse. It would later evolve into the Project on Government Oversight, or POGO, the most effective current watchdog when it comes to Pentagon spending. A recent POGO analysis, for instance, documented the malfeasance of Transdigm, a military parts supplier that the Department of Defense's Inspector General caught overcharging the Pentagon by as much as 3,800%. Yes, you read that figure right. On routine items, The company was able to do so only because, bizarrely enough, Pentagon buying rules prevent contract officers from getting accurate information on what any given item should cost or might cost the supplying company to produce it. The next level of Pentagon waste involves weapons they don't need at prices they can't afford. Systems that, for staggering sums, fail to deliver on promises to enhance the safety and security of Americans. The poster child for such costly, dysfunctional systems is F-35 combat aircraft, a plane tasked with multiple missions, none of which it does well. The Pentagon is slated to buy more than 2,400 F-35s for the Air Force, Marines, and Navy. The estimated lifetime cost for procuring and operating those planes, a mere $1.7 trillion, would make it the Pentagon's most expensive weapons project ever. Once upon a time, as in some fairy tale, the idea behind the creation of F-35 was to build a plane that, in several variations, would be able to carry out many different tasks relatively cheaply, with potential savings generated by economies of scale. Theoretically, that meant the bulk of the parts for the thousands of planes to be built would be the same for all of them. This approach has proven a dismal failure so far, so much so that the researchers at POGO are convinced that the F-35 may never be fully ready for combat. And its failures are too numerous to recount here. But a few examples should suffice to suggest why the program minimally needs to be scaled back in a major way, if not canceled completely. For a start, though meant to provide air support for troops on the ground, is proved anything but well designed to do so. In fact, that job is already handled far better and more cheaply by existing A-10 Warthog attack aircraft. A 2021 Pentagon assessment of the F-35, and keep in mind that this is the Department of Defense, not same outside expert, found 800 unresolved defects in the plane. Typical of its never-ending problems, a widely expensive and not particularly functional high-tech helmet, which at a cost of $400,000 each, is meant to give its pilot a special awareness of what's happening around and below the plane as well as to the horizon. And don't forget that the F-35 will be staggeringly expensive to maintain and already cost an impressive $38,000 an hour to fly. Unbelievably enough, the U.S. covered the globe military strategy, including a planet-wide footprint of more than 750 military bases, more than 200,000 troops stationed overseas, huge and costly aircraft carrier task forces eternally floating the seven seas, and a massive nuclear arsenal that could destroy life as we know it, with thousands of warheads to spare. You only need to look at the human and economic costs of America's post-9/11 wars to grasp the utter folly of such a strategy. According to Brown University's Cost of War Project, the conflicts waged by the United States in this century have cost $8 trillion and counting, with hundreds of thousands of civilian casualties, thousands of U.S. troops killed, and hundreds of thousands more suffering from traumatic brain injuries and post-traumatic stress disorder. And for what? In Iraq, the U.S. cleared the way for a sectarian regime that then helped create the conditions for Daesh to sweep in and conquer significant parts of the country, only to be repelled but not thoroughly defeated at a great cost in lives and treasure. Meanwhile, in Afghanistan, after conflict doomed as soon as it morphed into an exercise in nation-building and larger-scale counterinsurgency, the Taliban is now in power. It's hard to imagine a more ringing indictment of the policy of endless war. Despite the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan, spending on global counter-terror operations remains at high levels. Thanks to ongoing missions by special operations forces, repeated airstrikes, ongoing military aid and training, and other kinds of involvement short of full-scale war. Given the opportunity to rethink a strategy as part of a global force posture review released late last year, the Biden administration opted for a remarkably status quo approach, insisting on maintaining substantial bases in the West Asia-North Africa region, while modestly boosting the U.S. troop presence in East Asia. Despite the immediate headlines about spending on sending troops and planes to Eastern Europe and weapons to Ukraine in response to Russia's massing of its forces on that country's borders, the dominant narrative for keeping the Pentagon budget at its current size remains China. It matters little that the greatest challenges posed by America are political, economic, and military. The National Defense Strategy Commission, a congressionally mandated body charged with critiquing the Pentagon's official strategy document, drew more than half its members from individuals on the boards of arms-making corporations, working as consultants for the arms industry or from think tank heavily funded by just such contractors. Not surprisingly, the commission called for a 3% to 5% annual increase in the Pentagon budget into foreseeable future. Follow that blueprint and you are talking $1 trillion annually by the middle of this decade, according to an analysis by Taxpayers for Common Sense. Such an increase, in other words, would prove sustainable in a country where so much else is needed. But that won't stop Pentagon budget hawks from using it as their North Star. In March of this year, the Pentagon expected to release both its National Defense Strategy and its budget for 2023. There are a few small glimmers of hope, like reports that the administration may abandon certain dangerous and unnecessary nuclear weapons program instituted by the Trump administration. However, the true challenge crafting a budget that addresses genuine security problems like public health and the climate crisis would require fresh thinking and persistent public pressure to slash the Pentagon budget while reducing the size of the military-industrial complex. Without a significant change, of course, 2022 will once again be a banner year for Lockheed Martin and other top weapons makers at the expense of investing in programs necessary to combat urgent challenges from pandemics to climate change to global inequality.
Hello.
Happy New Year. Bye-bye.
We congratulate congratulate all Iranians and Persian-speaking peoples of the world on the occasion of Nowruz.
IRIB English Radio presents
Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Assalamu alaikum to dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. You're listening to I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sayyid Murtaza and Sayyid Mohsen. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum. Welcome to the show.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Sayyid Murtaza, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Thank you very much for inviting.
Thank you very much again for accepting my invitation to the program Viewpoints. Today we want to talk about the personality of Jesus Christ, or Isa ibn Maryam, Hazrat Masih. Also, these are the titles that are used for Prophet of Allah, and also Lady Mary or Hazrat Maryam, as pictured in the religion of Islam and the Quran, and the respect that Islam had for these two very dear personalities. Sayyid Murtaza, let's start with you, brother. How the religion of Islam looked at the very personality of Hazrat Masih?
Thank you very much. You know, Jesus, an English name,
yes,
and Mary, both are very special characters, and they have a special status, actually, in the religion of Islam, because these two characters have been compared to many other, you know, characters around the world, and their names have been many times mentioned and brought in the Book of Islam, Quran. So when Islam is bringing these two names and is quoting on them and is talking about their lifestyles and is providing the whole humanity some information how these people were faithful to God. So it shows that the religion of Islam is not only against Jesus and Mary, but also is supporting them and is asking people to respect them highly.
Yes.
So this is a picture that Islam draws of these two great personalities. Jesus is the prophet to God.
Yes.
And God revealed even a book, Gospel, to Jesus.
Yes.
So it shows that Jesus is one of the descendants of Abraham.
Yes.
So it shows that the prophet of Islam and Jesus both have their, you know, backgrounds the same.
Yes.
So it shows that Islam has compared Jesus and Mary with many other personalities, and the great respect has been given to them.
That's right. But Sayyid Mohsen, the look that even some of the Christian communities has at their own prophets and their books is very much different from what the religion of Islam has. And this makes a question that who knows better is religion? You know, the followers of the same religion or the followers of the religion that comes, you know, so many years after that? What's your answer to that?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, when we talk about the Islam is not a separate religion from what Jesus Christ brought for the people of that time. We should bear in mind that the Judaism or Christianity, this word Christianity or Judaism,
yes,
this is a word which was made by people themselves, and not this name wasn't put by the prophets over the people. For example, Jesus did not said like, whoever will follow me or whoever I'm preaching, they are Christians.
Okay.
This deviation and the, yes, names were put by the people themselves.
Yes.
Whereas in the Quran, Allah says Bani Israel.
Okay.
There's no Judaism. And obviously, when we see this, like the people who later put a specific name for themselves because they're attaching themselves to someone. So they got the name of Christianity and the Judaism. When we talk about the Islam, we have many verses in the Quran, and there are many proofs in the Quran, the verses that say, like, all the prophets who came, they all brought one thing, and that was Islam itself. Means submitting to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Islam in its literal meaning, submitting. And Muslim also means, or the Muslim, when we say Muslim, it means the one who submits.
Yes.
So all the prophets, they asked their people to submit to one God, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Yes.
And that was the main theme of every single prophet. So when we say, like, do we know more? Does Islam knows more, or the people who are following? We should also look at the history that the gospel which brother has referred to, when it was written later, like after like 400 years of Jesus. Like,
you mean this is not the same text that was revealed?
No, it wasn't the same text which was said by the Jesus. It was written 400 years after that.
Okay.
And the Old Testament that we have, it was written 1,000 years after the Moses.
Okay.
So we need to look at the historical aspect as well. Whereas the Quran, when we're talking about the Quran itself, it was written at the time of the Prophet, and he dictated the verses which used to reveal.
Okay.
So I don't think this is a right question, like if we want to say, or it is not right to say, like the Muslims do not know about the Jesus because they are not the follower. We are the hard follower of Jesus and Moses and Abraham as well, because they are our prophets. And to become a Muslim must believe in 124,000 prophets, from which there is a Jesus and there is Moses. And in the Quran, we can see many times Allah has said, Isa ibn Maryam. He refers to the Jesus, son of Mary.
That's right.
And also to the prophet Abraham and the Moses. And we know that the Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, they all are the Abrahamic religions. So when the main person who's like, we call ourselves Abrahamic, so we all refer back to Ibrahim alayhi salam.
And the monotheistic wonder religions all across the world. But say, Murtaza, you know, the question is now, we must have enough knowledge about the previous religions too. You know, as a Muslim, and this is when maybe some of the Muslims around the world does not have enough knowledge about their own religions and the details around. And I think this gives us a kind of authenticity about how the religions were revealed to the prophets of Allah during the history, and how the religion of Islam could complete the previous versions of the religions. Isn't so?
You know, historically talking, everyone needs actually to learn a lesson from history. And when it comes to speaking about religions and the background of religions, and the religions that were actually before and after one another. So let's look at Jesus Christ and his mother Mary in the Book of Islam. And we know that the Book of Islam, Quran specifically, has put a great emphasis on Jesus' presence in society and Mary in society as well. So, you know, these two acted strongly like messengers, and they actually received messages from God, and then it was disseminated and distributed among people. So the same two roles have been, you know, followed and have been taken by Jesus Christ and his mother. So it shows a footstep to all of us that we need to follow in their footsteps, like we Muslims must follow in footsteps of our prophets and all our infallible imams.
That's right.
So it shows to all of us that what has been preached, it must be practiced.
That's right.
So unfortunately, we don't have this. In Christianity, unfortunately, we have a lot of rules that most of them have been overlooked by Christians.
Yes.
And in Judaism, we have the same thing, because I had my personal studies related to these factors.
Okay.
We have commonalities, we have similarities between religions, but unfortunately, those rules, the very effective rules, have been overlooked by the followers. And it shows that Islam as a religion has a better understanding, has a better description of the role of Jesus Christ and his mother.
That's right.
So it shows that people need to learn a very good lesson from the history and look at the picture how Islam actually created of Jesus Christ and his mother.
That's right. But Sayyid Mohsen, what was the main reason of revealing such ayahs to the Prophet of Islam in Arab Peninsula about the previous prophets, especially Prophet Masih, you know, Isa ibn Maryam, Jesus Christ, and Lady Mary? This is really a great question to be asked, you know, that what was the main reason? I mean, what is the use? For example, the ignorant Arabs, the Jahiliyyah Arab on that time, being familiar with the previous prophets, was there any intention behind that?
Well, first of all, let me just make clear that when we talk about the Arabs, the way you said jahil or ignorant.
Sorry, no, at the time of Jahiliyyah, sorry.
Even when we use the word Jahiliyyah, that does not mean they were ignorant. You know, they had the best poets, and when they used to hear a poem from someone, they used to memorize it at the spot. Okay. So that they were intelligent at that time. The jahalat is something else. The jahalat we refer because they were worshipping idols.
Okay.
They were not worshipping the God and the religions, the Abrahamic religions. That's why, you know, they were in the jahalat, in the darkness. This jahalat means darkness, not the ignorance.
Okay.
That's the first thing.
Okay.
The second thing is, when we look at the prophets, we see that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has sent 124,000 prophets. But we don't see their names in the Quran, not all of them.
Yes.
The answer is, if the Quran was the book of history, then you would find all the names with their date of birth, I don't know, date of demise, and the place where they were. Whereas the Quran is the book of guidance. It has revealed to give guidance and give lesson to the people, to take people towards the right path. Therefore, those prophets who are mentioned in the Quran, number one, they are ulul azm. Like all the ulul azm, like the, you can say, the supreme prophets. There are six of them. But we have like Prophet Nuh, Prophet Abraham, Prophet Musa, Prophet Jesus, Prophet Muhammad, and Prophet Adam, alayhi salam, the first prophet. So these prophets, six prophets, they're ulul azm, basically. Or if some, like according to some, they don't count Prophet Adam, alayhi salam, then we have five.
Five, that's
plus
right.
Plus Prophet Adam.
Five account is right, too.
All these prophets are mentioned,
yes.
Number one. Number two, the rest of the prophets, like Prophet Khizr and other prophets, why they're discussed in the Quran? Because this book is book of guidance. So Allah needs to give guidance. Therefore, these prophets who are mentioned, all of them, they were the, we can say, like, they have all those characters which the rest of the prophets from 124,000 prophets had. And it was, we can say, they have it collectively in themselves. And all the characters which all the prophets from Adam alayhi salam till Jesus had, all of them were in the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. So we have these narrations and these things. So why the Jesus has been discussed in the Quran? It's because, number one, the followers of that religion, Christianity, are still in the world. They were at that time, at the time of the Prophet. Similarly, the story of the Musa alayhi salam of Bani Israel, it is also mentioned. The others as well.
That's right.
The polytheists, the stories of the polytheists are also mentioned, okay. Like mushrikeen, the idol worshippers, and all those. So basically, it's because we have many people who are still the followers of such prophets, those prophets, number one. Number two, because these prophets, the characteristics of these prophets, this were in a way that they have become a role model, not for the people of their time, but for the people even after them. And because there's many discussions, especially in the Christianity, they believe that the Jesus is Son of God.
Mm-hmm.
This is what they believe.
Trinity.
Yeah, Trinity. Yes. They believe that Jesus is Son of God. On the other hand, in the Quran, we have seen, like in the history as well, that Mubahila has happened between the Muslims and the Christians.
Christians, that's right.
The main base was that there were some Christians who came from Najran to Medina to see what this prophet, new prophet, is saying. And when they came there, they said to the prophet that we believe in Jesus, Son of God. And the Prophet Muhammad said, I believe in Jesus, Prophet of God.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, you are basically reducing the status of the Jesus from being son to the prophet, and you made him a servant of God. He's not the servant, he is the Son of God.
Okay.
And then Prophet argued, Prophet said, what do you believe? What is your belief about the Adam alayhi salam? They said he was the servant of God. Then the Prophet said, Adam neither had the father nor mother. So he should enjoy that status of being the Son of God, whereas Jesus had the mother at least. So these were the arguments. So why Jesus is there? Because even in the Quran, we have the verse that Jesus has said, O Allah, I never said them that I'm your son. I'm your prophet, and you need to judge between us on the day of judgment.
Okay.
So the other reason, the second reason is because of the many followers of such religions. Therefore, it is necessary to talk about such prophets so that these people can come back to the right path.
That's right.
And the deviation which they had from the right religion, they should basically refer back. And that's why the Quran is talking about the Jesus alayhi salam, the Virgin Mary, the role of Gabriel as an angel of revelation, and the other prophets as well.
That's all right. And really, there must be a lesson in all these life accounts of the previous prophets in the Holy Quran for not only the Muslims, but also, you know, the people of other generations who want to be familiar with their own historical account of the life of the prophets and the great personalities like Lady Mary. And, Lady Mary, has really a special status. She's believed by the Muslims to be among the outstanding role models for the ladies all around the world. Isn't it, Sayyid Mirza?
Of course, yes. Role models and these great characters must have something to teach us. And if we can't find a lesson to learn from them, I don't think we can call them role models.
Yes.
And the Book of Islam is full of stories about these great characters. Jesus Christ himself and his mother, Lady Mary, both of these two names have been mentioned many times. Specifically, Lady Mary, I think her name has been mentioned over 34, 35 times. And it shows her great status in the Book of Islam. So these two characters, not only for Christians, but also for all humanity, have something to deliver. So in today's world, I think the followers of Islam and the followers of all religions must look into the private, social, and personal lifestyles of these two characters, because certainly we will find a lot of merits and advantages that we can pick up and use them in our own life. So I don't think it is right and correct to say that Muslims, for example, should not celebrate the birthday of Jesus Christ.
Okay.
So it doesn't show that Muslims are following the Christianity. It
yes.
shows that they show their great respect
that's right.
to the birth of Jesus Christ.
Okay.
So today is the Jesus birthday. So
yeah, December 25th,
Muslims,
that's right.
So all Muslims must respect.
Yes.
And if they celebrate, I don't think it's wrong.
Yes.
It's not because of the Christianity. It's
yes.
because of the Holy Prophet
yes.
that his name has been directly
yes.
mentioned many times in the Book of Islam.
That's
so
right.
there is a lesson for us.
Yes.
That we have to follow all these religions,
yes.
all these prophets, and respect them as much as we can.
As we could see in the Islamic Republic of Iran, there are so many Christians living. And on these days, from December 25th to January 1st, they are celebrating the celebration in their own churches in Tehran, in Yazd, in Shiraz, and in different places in Isfahan, all around the Islamic Republic of Iran, shows how much the also religious minorities like Christianity are respected in an Islamic land, the Shia Islamic land like Iran. Thank you, my Sayyid Mirza and Sayyid Mohsen, for your presence in the program. And again, congratulations on the birthday anniversary of Isa ibn Maryam, Prophet Jesus Christ, and also congratulations to all our Christian brothers and sisters all around the world. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to us. This was Viewpoints. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/ and Call of Islam page. Also, our YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
عيسى بن مريم عليهما السلام بشر أتباعه بنبي يأتي من بعده اسمه أحمد، وأحمد هو محمد صلى الله عليه وسلم.
عيسى نبي الله قال مبشرا. بعدي سيأتي أحمد ومحمد.
يا معشرا وصفوا المحمد بالقبيح، قد كان أولى أن تقولوا كالمسيح، من كان يتبع
ربنا.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program The Key here at IRIB English Radio. Thank you for joining us here today. Today on The Key, we're going to be examining a question which is very important, very pertinent, very significant. And that question is regarding the permissibility of praying for disbelievers. You know, a lot of people in this world who are Muslims, they live in non-Muslim countries. Or they might live in countries which are predominantly Muslim, but which in which there is a significant portion of the population is non-Muslim. A lot of people are converts to Islam. They have non-Muslim relatives. And, you know, so these people often, you know, they have friends who are Muslims. They have relatives who are Muslims. You know, they love these people, you know, and they want to pray for them just like as they pray for their Muslim relatives or Muslim friends. So sometimes they ask, is it permissible for us to pray for Muslims? Because a lot of for non-Muslims, a lot of times, you know, this question comes up because in certain verses of the Holy Quran, it seems to be that God is almost saying that this is not permissible. For example, in one verse of the Holy Quran, we read that God says, the prophet and the people who are believers are not supposed to ask forgiveness for the polytheists, even if they are their closest relatives. This verse seems to say that, no, this is not permissible. You can't do that. Right. So what's the deal? Can we pray for them or not? If we examine the continuation of this verse, we find the answer to this. In continuation, God says, he adds a clause to this prohibition. He says, after it becomes clear to them that they, meaning those polytheists, are the inhabitants of heaven, are the inhabitants of hell. Meaning after it becomes, they become sure that these people are the inhabitants of hell, it's impermissible for a Muslim to pray for them. The converse of this obviously is that no, if we're not sure about it, we can actually pray for them. We can actually ask forgiveness for them. We can ask God to guide them to the straight path. You know, this is something that's actually reinforced by some other verses of the Holy Quran, this permissibility. For example, we read in the Holy Quran the following regarding the conduct of the Prophet Abraham, alayhi salam, who was the father of monotheism and the father of the Abrahamic faiths. You know, one of his uncle, whose name was Azar, right? He was a polytheist and he was a very staunch polytheist. He was very opposed to Ibrahim, Hazrat Ibrahim, and he spoke very threateningly with him. For example, in the Holy Quran we read, that, oh, Abraham, are you inclining away from my God? From my God? If you do not finish what you're doing, I will stone you and I will exile you from myself. Right? So this is a very staunch polytheist. He's not even a very like a lenient polytheist. Right? But let's look at what Abraham said to him in response to this. Abraham said, peace be upon you. I will soon ask forgiveness for you from my Lord. Right? Right, so Hazrat Abraham, he prayed for his uncle, Azar, right, even though he was a staunch polytheist. And in continuation, God Almighty clarifies this even more, right, reinforcing what we talked about earlier. God says, after it became clear for Abraham that he, meaning his uncle, Azar, was an enemy of God, he sought refuge from him, in God. I mean, he no longer prayed for him. Right? So this automatically reinforces what we talked about earlier, that it is permissible to pray for non-Muslims as long as we're not sure that they are the inhabitants of hell and that there's no chance for their guidance any longer. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the possibility and permissibility of praying for non-Muslims according to the verses of the Holy Quran. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.